Gender diversity has become an unbelievably outsized issue in the public discourse over the past few years. And by outsized, I mean that an estimated less than 1% of the population have become targets for politicians and bigots and internet pundits seeking clout. The rhetoric around the use of bathrooms, transgender women in sport, gender reassignment surgery for youth, has become a culture war issue that's spilled into real policy that does real damage. I believe one of the reasons for this is that non-cisgender people make up such a tiny portion of the population, many of us don't know anyone who is non-binary or transgender, or at least, we don't know that we know them. The atmosphere right now for gender-diverse people is akin to the one that faced lesbian, gay, and bisexual people a couple of decades ago. They were persecuted, excluded from many public spaces, and not given the same rights that heterosexual people took for granted. Now, we still haven't fully solved that problem either, and the recent anti-trans talk has brought back to prominence a lot of those anti-gay prejudices many of us had hoped were gone forever. My name is Eric Bowman. I'm the communications person at the Canadian Psychological Association, and this is Mindful. Today's episode marks the start of a four-part series on gender identity. We're going to talk about the increase in anti-trans legislation, the increase in hate crimes against gender-diverse people, and the atmosphere in Canada that's becoming increasingly hostile to people who do not identify as cisgender. Now, this episode was originally recorded in October, before the legislation in New Brunswick, before the unscientific and dangerous proposals out of Alberta, before the death of Next Benedict in Oklahoma. To kick off this series, I wanted to speak with the friend I trust the most to illuminate these issues.
Hello, my name is Ada Sinakor, and I am a professor at McGill University, and I direct the Social Justice and Diversity Research Lab. I also co-chair the Human Rights and Social Justice Committee of the Canadian Psychological Association, and my research expertise is in social justice and human rights.
And I think that's kind of where I want to start, is in research expertise. And right now we're looking at all of these policies being enacted across the United States and now here in Canada, six different provinces passing essentially anti-trans legislation and not listening to those who have the research expertise in these areas. The research is out there. The data is out there. The facts are out there. And it seems like so many government officials are ignoring that or trying hard not to hear it and not inviting any of the people with the expertise in to discuss these matters before they go ahead and pass something based on the loudest voices in the room, really. And I'm wondering where you think we are right now here in Canada. Overall, in terms of advancing the rights of trans people, the rights of LGBTQ people, two-spirited people, with all of this kind of making it feel like we're going backwards?
Well, I think we are feeling like we're going backwards. And I think that there is a whittling away of the rights of 2SLGBTIA plus individuals. We know that hate crimes against the 2SLGBTIA plus communities are at an all-time high. EGAL reported over 4,000 between January 1st and March 30th, which included social media and all kinds of things. So there's a real concern about that. And then this, what we're seeing happening as well is kind of this focus on schools and gender-affirming education. And that's really where there's a big push against gender-affirming education in schools, which results in putting trans and gender-diverse youth at higher risks of negative health outcomes, suicide, bullying, et cetera.
Yeah, and it strikes me that the reason that schools become such a touch point for this debate and this fight is that it becomes easy to create propaganda to convince people that they have to protect children. And the way to protect children is this, that, or the other thing, right? And I think, you know, both sides of this, the science side that says gender-affirming care helps children, it prevents suicide, it makes every outcome in their lives better. They're trying to protect children. And on the other side, you have a concerted propaganda effort convincing people that schools are doing all kinds of terrible things to children. And they genuinely think, I think a lot of them genuinely think that they're protecting kids by making sure this doesn't happen in school. And I do suspect that the people who are pushing the agenda know full well that they're wrong, but it's something that they can make people upset about, and they know how to do that, right? Does that make sense to you? Is that kind of what you're seeing?
So let's talk a little bit about schools, right? Schools are places where kids learn, grow, and they explore all kinds of identities, right? They explore all kinds of interests. Schools should be, unfortunately, they aren't always, safe places for children and youth to be able to actualize and explore all kinds of things. When we see these kinds of restrictions being brought into schools, we're basically telling certain youth that they're not allowed to have that freedom of expression and that freedom of exploration that other youth are able to have. And so the schools then kind of create these tensions, which result in putting gender diverse and sexual minority youth at risk, but both at risk for bullying and at risk for kind of mistreatment from adults as well. So when we see what's happening across the country and in the United States, the debates are really, what do we know? We know that kids are figuring out their gender identity from a very young age. We know that allowing a child to explore their gender identity means that they'll land on a gender identity that is consistent for them, right? It doesn't right. mean that we're going to, everybody all of a sudden is going to be trans and gender non-binary, right?
Yeah.
We'll still have the diversity of genders we have now. So gender-affirming education and gender-affirming care affirms all genders. Like, it's not just about trans and gender diverse. It's about all genders being affirmed in positive, strength-based ways, right?
Yeah.
What we're seeing in the debate around schools, one of the things we're seeing is in this kind of conservative agenda, if you will, is a setting up of polarization to a certain extent, where we're going to have us versus them, right? And so now when you're looking at some of the protests that we're seeing across the country, you have the protesters and the counter-protesters.
Right.
And so what does that mean? Well, the first place we're seeing that polarization be is this debate about parental rights versus the rights of the child, right? So but the parental rights they're talking about are typically related to conservative religious parental rights. So rights of people who don't want to support, who would not necessarily be so supportive of a trans or gender diverse child. Those children who have non-supportive family members and non-supportive schools are higher risk for homelessness, higher risk for poor health outcomes, higher risk for suicide, and it can go on and on, right?
Right. Poverty, food insecurity. I mean, every metric exactly. that we measure in society, right? Yeah.
Right. So when policies are driven by conservative parental rights, the supportive parental rights are now being violated. Because if I want my child to be in a school that's gender affirming, that has gender affirming education, that is appropriate sex education, and we're talking about we're talking about romantic relationships and all kinds of things, right? Not just right. about, if I want that for my child and the school's policies are no, then my rights as a supportive parent are now being violated. So we're basically setting up a system where the rights of conservative right-wing religious parents outweigh the rights of other parents. And all of this outweighs the rights of the child, right?
Yeah.
So then we're saying, well, what about the rights of the child? Does a child have the right to become the person they are are or need to become or are exploring to become? Is that the right of the child? And that's where we're seeing a lot of division. And that's where we're seeing some of this mythology that comes up, where, you know, this whole mythology around, well, trans people are predators in bathrooms. That's mythology.
Right.
This mythology that, you know, where automatically, you know, the doing surgical transition or hormone therapy with kids who are really young. These things are just not accurate. And that's not the way it works, right? There's
right.
many, many non-medical gender affirming ways to work with children, right? People
yeah.
just are thinking about the medical piece. And the medical piece is important to talk about, but that's where things get moved towards, promoted in these kind of fear-mongering ways. But there's a lot of other ways that gender-affirming education works as well. And we're not hearing about that either. So we're not hearing about the rights of the supportive parent. We're not hearing about what does gender-affirming education really look like and how does it really support all genders? And what does it mean? What does the rights of the child mean in terms of their own identity developments?
And I think that a lot of that, especially something like the bathroom thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that somewhere along the way, people get this idea. And I think it's the same thing when they start arguing against trans women competing in sports. And it is that, what if I, a regular heterosexual male, decided I was going to change my gender identity so that I could win, you know, the 30 kilometer race walk at the next Olympics, or so that I could go into a bathroom presenting as a woman and do I don't know what I would like. I mean, I presumably you could just walk into a bathroom anyway. If you're a predator, it's not a right. And I think that that is a lot of this notion against these things, right? What if I decided that I was going to do that? And I don't think people realize that that's not an option for people, right? That you can't just decide that you're going to transition and then go win an Olympic event. That's not how it works.
Well, look, the controversy around trans athletes has been an interesting one. And this whole notion that we are testing testosterone in trans women is really problematic, because we're not testing testosterone in the men. And we're not saying, well, this man has a higher level of testosterone, so they're more likely to win an event. Like,
right.
So we're not doing that, right? So it really is a way to target people that in really problematic and problematic ways. Well, when you think about this idea of transitioning, or I mean, let's understand what that means, right? There's different ways in which people have move towards a congruence between their identity, right? Which may be different than their assigned sex. Not, you know, the whole notion of transition or achieving congruence, it may just be about social congruence, right? Like I feel like I can be who I am based on my pronouns, my chosen name, the way I dress, the way I manage my body and understand my body, et cetera, et cetera. There's psychological congruence. I feel connected to my gender identity in a very fundamental way. You know, and then for some, there's surgical congruence, right? So when we think about social, psychological, emotional congruence, there's all kinds of ways in which we can support people in becoming congruent with their gender identity. And then when it comes to people who it's important to have a surgical transition, that's a process as well that we can support people to. But typically that process happens later on, right? Like early on, we might be supporting people with the social, emotional, psychological congruence. And through that, people are better able to make informed decisions about whether or not they want to go through any kind of medical congruent procedures, right? So it's not so simple, number one, in terms of what it looks like.
Right.
Number two, I think it's very difficult to come out to yourself as a person who is either trans or gender diverse. And those are different experiences, right?
Yeah.
Right? Because a person who identifies as trans typically will say, I was assigned girl at birth, but I really experience myself as a boy, right? Not
right.
everybody identifies with that. So somebody who's gender diverse, may say, well, I don't experience myself as a boy or a girl. I experience myself as something in between, you know, or something different than that. And it's not that I need to necessarily change my body to be more aligned with what I'm experiencing as my gender identity, but there's other ways in which I need to manage my gender identity in order to feel congruent with who I am as a person in the world. And those are different experiences, and they're individual to each person who goes through that process, right? So my experience is going to be different than somebody else. And when we're talking about over time, these discussions are not new. We've been talking about this for a very, very long time. But how youth explore these things is by given the opportunity to think about them. Like, they may know, but not feel like they have the opportunity to talk about it or explore it. And
right.
then once they move out of their parents' home, they then begin to have, perhaps begin that process.
I think too, a lot of the time they don't really know, right? They know something's off, something's a little wrong, but they can't really put a finger on it. And unless they're given a space to explore that, they may never come to the actual conclusion that they should have come to much earlier. I know my daughter was at school and this was not talked about at school. This was not part of the curriculum in any way. Like, the school was in high school anyway, was very against talking about any of this stuff, sex ed and the rest of it. And it wasn't until after she left high school where somebody just offhand referred to her as a girl, and it sort of clicked in her head, like, wait a second, that really felt good. That felt affirming. That might actually be. And then she was able to explore it a little bit more, but was afraid to even discuss that something feels wrong when she was in school, because there weren't really any groups or clubs or teachers that she could approach with this.
I'd like to reframe that a little bit, Eric, if you're okay with that, because it's an important point that you're making. It's a very, very important point. And I think that the language of the word wrong is language we need to kind of be thinking about, because we want to talk about these things from a strength-based, resiliency, positive place. So I know there's something different about me. I can't put my finger on it. I don't know how to talk about it. And I don't have any opportunity to see it anywhere else. But there is something very, very different about me that is impossible to articulate without any opportunity to know that it even exists.
Right.
Right. And so when I think about this, I also think about, well, when I was young, I knew I was different, but I couldn't figure out what it was. And there was no conversations around it. When I talk to young people, they'll say the same thing. Well, I knew I was different, but I didn't know how to talk about it. And so one of the kind of the misnomers out there is that, oh, well, if we talk about it, all of a sudden, everybody's going to want to change their gender.
Right.
Like, oh, we're going to confuse kids by talking about it. We don't confuse people through good information and appropriate education. Right?
Right. Yeah.
We open up a world to them that they get to think about. But you're not going to take somebody who really identifies as cisgendered and heterosexual and all of a sudden give them opportunities and good information about gender diversity, and then all of a sudden they're going to say, oh, I want to be that, right?
Right.
It's, it, it doesn't work that way, right? Like, if you think about it, you know, like, most people are raised by cisgendered heterosexual parents.
Yes.
Right. And so if you look at the two LGBTIA plus communities, most people were raised by cisgendered heterosexual parents, and it didn't make them cisgendered and heterosexual because that's all they were exposed to.
Right. Right.
Right. We don't think about it that way. So this notion that good, positive, strength-based, gender-affirming education is going to get kids to change their genders is just not an accurate of what we know happens when we do positive gender affirming care and education in schools and in and with regard to pediatricians and healthcare and those kinds of things. So we know that, right? The other thing too is, if a kid says, you know, I am going to explore this, and then they say, you know what, this isn't for me, I am cisgendered, that's not a failure. That's a positive thing that they actually got to have that exploration and land in a place that makes them feel like, I feel really confident about this, right?
Right.
Even though they may have been questioning their gender identity at some point, right? So I think sometimes we think, if we think that education serves the purpose of conversion, there's a lot of education that we shouldn't be providing anybody.
Right.
Because that's just not the way education works. Not if we're providing good, accurate, age-appropriate information to youth and young adults.
And I think that might be the one place where there's a legitimate debate to be had, which is, what is age-appropriate, right? But that debate has to be framed in the context of what we know to be true, in the context of the science that's out there, in the context of all of the information that the experts know about this. Then you can make that decision. What is age appropriate? At what age can people start learning about this, that, and the other thing? Versus what seems to be happening now, which is that nothing is age appropriate. Even, you know, you shouldn't be learning about this even when you're, you know, 22 years old. You shouldn't be learning about gender identity, and you shouldn't be learning about homosexual relationships until you're in your 30s or whatever, right? There's a bizarre sort of use of the phrase age appropriate to sort of shut down all of this discussion.
So let's talk about that a minute, because again, parents are talking about gender and sexuality with their kids all the time.
Right.
And so are teachers. So if you read a picture book and there's a man and a woman who are having a new baby, that's a conversation about gender and sexuality. And what right. age is that happening? That's happening at 3, 4, 5 year old, whenever anybody's having their second child. If a teacher is pregnant, right, we're talking about gender and sexuality.
Yes.
Right. And so we're having these conversations without labeling them as these conversations. Right. So when people say we want no gender and no sexuality in schools, and when I see the protests, those are the kinds of signs that people are holding. I'm like, but you have cisgender and heterosexuality in schools. So you're really saying we want no discussion around gender diversity or sexual minorities in schools. Where you have same-sex parents bringing their kids to school. So how do you not have that conversation? You know, and their kids, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, their kids love their parents the same way kids love their heterosexual parents, and don't, you know, sexualize their parents' relationships the way many people sexualize same-sex relationships. That's not what kids are doing when they're dropped off at school with their parents. They're just happy that they have loving parents.
Right. And it does take an external force, I think, to sexualize something that is otherwise not sexualized in its context, right? The drag queen story hour and all these other things are, you can look at it through that lens and then find a way to sexualize it and therefore create a taboo around it where, you know, you have this sort of Puritan notion that nothing sexualized can show up in front of children. But it sort of misses the larger picture in a lot of ways, I think, right?
Right. And when we talk about appropriate gender affirming education and sexuality affirming education, we're talking about people, how people are relating to each other. So, when you talk about kids, for example, and this came up in my class the other day, it was a good example. We oftentimes put an adult meaning on children's behavior.
Right.
So if in kindergarten a boy and a girl are holding hands, all of a sudden they're boyfriend and girlfriend. So right there we've put a sexual orientation on meaning on that relationship when they're just friends holding hands, right? And so what we need to start thinking about and being cognizant of is how are we putting adult meanings on children's behavior, which is not what it means. And two, what is the risk of showing, reading a picture book to a kid that has all different kinds of family structures, right? That,
Right.
has heterosexual parents, same-sex parents, grandparents who are raising their kids, et cetera, et cetera. That's the reality of the world. And for those kids who that's their reality, that gives them a sense of, I fit into this world. And what do we know about health, right? One of the things we know about mental health is people need a sense of belongingness and uniqueness.
Right.
So when you have an education that gives people a sense of belongingness, that's really important because that helps them feel like I'm a part of something. And in that education, when you allow for a discussion around diversity, all kinds of diversity, that also gives them a sense of uniqueness. So I both belong here in this school, feel accepted and included in this school, but I also bring something unique to this school, and that can be celebrated as well.
I mean, is that really what gender-affirming care looks like in school? Is it simply a space to explore this and sense of belonging and bringing something to the school as well? Is it simply belonging and uniqueness? Is that the overarching theme of what gender-affirming care can do? Or is there a little more to it than that? Is there more, if a child says, I do want to explore this, should there be an adult who can explore that with them? Should there be somebody who's knowledgeable about that, who can really take them through some of that and help them explore? Or can they do that with peers?
That's a really good question. And I don't think that they can necessarily do that with peers. That's why when you think about gender-affirming education, teachers and school counselors play a really, really important role in providing that education. Or sometimes maybe you'll bring in somebody who can work with teachers and school counselors to ensure that they're appropriately providing that education. We know from the research that having an affirmative adult in a trans or gender diverse youth's life makes a huge difference in wellness outcomes, right?
Right.
And so we also know that youth who have gender affirming parents, the risk of negative health outcomes reduces significantly. So we need to ensure that the youth have the opportunity to work through these identity questions with supportive adults. And when you see the policies that are being passed, some of these policies that are being passed, that we can't talk about this in school, or if a child wants to change their pronoun or use a different name, that you need to get a parent's consent form signed. Well, for a parent who's supportive, that policy is problematic to begin with when we talk about parental rights versus child rights. But just let's look at that policy for a minute. If that permission slip's going to a parent who's supportive, who probably has already had these conversations with their child, that doesn't put the child at risk. But the parent who's not going to be supportive, and then that permission slip goes home, that might put the child at risk, right? For
Yes, right.
homelessness and other kinds of things. So we're not thinking about the risks to the child when there's non-supportive adults in their life, right? And we did a research looking at gender-affirming parents and the struggles that they had and some of the challenges that they had and the judgments that they had to deal with as a result of being gender-affirming. And so that kind of prejudice around gender diversity not only gets imposed on the child, but sometimes it's also imposed on parents from other parents who don't want their kids to be exposed to gender-affirming content.
I want to pivot just a little bit in the last time we have here and talk about, we've been talking about schools and younger children now, but you're at McGill, right? An Institute of Higher Learning, universities, you're teaching a lot of this kind of stuff. And we've spoken in the past a little bit about this culture of fear that has sort of come over, not only students who take these classes, but teachers who teach these classes, professors who deal with this kind of thing. We've seen an actual attack in a classroom in Canada on a teacher who was teaching gender studies, right? That there is this sort of intentional, I think, targeting of people who do this. And I'm not sure I can really wrap my head around why, right? That seems to be a different level of thing. And the fact that you're teaching the science that you've researched, that you fully know, but that people have decided must be wrong because of, I don't know, this propaganda that they're being fed, are now targeting those people specifically. And I'm hoping you can tell me just a little bit about that. Like, what is it like teaching in that environment? And are you constantly aware of it?
That's a good question, Eric. Yes, I'm always aware of it. Like, as somebody who identifies as gender diverse, I'm particularly sensitive to it, but then I'm always aware of it because you're kind of a public figure when you're working at a university and you're teaching these courses. And I think because people get all kinds of threats as a result of doing this work, there's a level of awareness about the risks. And we've seen those risks come into fruition, and the stabbing of the teacher in Canada is just one example. But I think we started seeing this, you know, kind of this raise in hate and fear mongering, if you will. I mean, it got connected to many things, which got exacerbated by the pandemic, right? So it kind of got connected to anti-masking, and it got connected to vaccines and the truckers in Ottawa. And there was all kinds of things that kind of this put wheels in motion that elevated people's anger and outrage. And that started getting targeting certain populations. So if you look at like the highest rates of hate crimes across the country, it's, you know, people of color, Jewish people, anti-Semitism, and 2SLGBI2S+, as well as sexual violence has also increased in many, many ways. So what's happening in our society that people are so angry and feeling like they are emboldened to now threaten people who don't share their ideology, opinions, et cetera? Well, social media has something to do with that, right? And then there's this research that shows how if somebody is just right of center, if you can get them outraged through social media, they'll start following you. And then that outrage leads to more outrage and more outrage and more outrage. And so the goal of the person who wants to get that person outraged to move them further to the right is to keep people angry.
Right.
Because if people stay angry, they get more hits, right? And they get more hits, they make more money. So there's a financial benefit to keeping people angry, which I don't think that consumers of this kind of social media are particularly aware of, right? That psychological process that occurs with social media. Now, I'm not a media psychologist, but I've read quite a bit about this and from media psychologists who are basically saying we need to be thinking about this. And so then when it comes to, you know, things like something that people just don't understand, which I think gender diversity is something people just don't understand, they become afraid of things they don't understand. And then that fear mongering, et cetera, is easier to manipulate.
Yeah.
So to your question, like, I try very hard to present my classes from a strength-based perspective. One of the classes I teach is geared for teachers working in schools, and it's on gender and sexuality. And we talk about the challenges they're facing right now in schools. But I also can't walk through life being afraid all the time.
Right.
So I have my moments where I try to compartmentalize that. And I have people who I can process what's happening with. But I think if I let myself be afraid all the time, which would be possible given my areas of expertise in the work I do, I don't think I could be effective as a teacher, as a researcher, as a family member.
Ada brings up an interesting point when it comes to the confluence of prejudice. Anti-trans prejudice really goes hand in hand with anti-Semitism, with anti-Black racism. All the conspiracy theories, like Ada mentions, the anti-mask movement, the anti-vaccine movement, tend to lead people down this tunnel to a place that very often ends at anti-Semitism. Ada and I recorded this conversation on the day it came out that Elon Musk may well have been following a very specific white supremacist playbook on how to destroy Twitter, which started with the increase in racist vitriol on the platform, then resulted in advertisers leaving it, and ended in him blaming the Anti-Defamation League for the fact that Twitter had become less and less profitable. That's something we'll touch on later in this series as we continue looking at gender diversity in Canada and the forces arrayed against the provision of science-backed affirming care for the people who need it most. Our next episode comes out in 2 weeks when we'll be talking about cisnormativity in healthcare with Dr. Jesse Bosse and Francoise Sucette. Thanks to Dr. Ada Sinicor for kicking off our series with a thoughtful conversation, and to you at home for listening, streaming, downloading, and reviewing today's episode. As always, Mindful is written, hosted, and published by me, Eric Bowman. Our producer and editor is Jamie Montgomery, and our theme song is Avenues by David Taylor.